Hi, my name is Dick Miller. I teach in philosophy and I'm director of the program in ethics and public life. Today's visitor in the EPL series on the politics and ethics of the rise of China is Joseph Chan. In China, as in the United States, people feel a great need for an adequate, shared ethical basis for public life. There, as here, people don't think that freedom to get as rich as you can is an adequate basis. Joseph Chan has made a rich and diverse contribution to meeting that need in China and here over many years. Joseph is professor and chair of the Department of Politics and Public Administration at the University of Hong Kong. He's also founding director there of the Center for Civil Society and Governance. Like most people in Anglo-American political philosophy, I first got to know Joseph Chan's work through challenging arguments that he made that inevitably and properly political choices depend on the valuing of some ways of life as better than others. In such influential articles as legitimacy, unanimity, and perfectionism, Joseph challenged us that really didn't seem entirely liberal, that view that politics should be used to advance certain ways of life in preference to others. And yet, one had to admit that Joseph's approach to this question captured profound truths in liberal political philosophy while saying that they weren't the whole truth. He wanted to promote the goodness of lives, and yet he was deeply concerned with the goodness of being tolerant. That philosophical project has been combined in Joseph's activity with a deeply practical project as director of the Center for Civil Society and Governance in Hong Kong. He has led their vital efforts in research and advocacy to promote freedom and democracy in Hong Kong. In recent years, the practical and the philosophical have been combined in Joseph's work. His great project is now to derive an ethical basis for political discourse in China now from Confucian political thought. That's been the project advance in a series of influential articles. It will culminate in a book soon to appear, Confucian Political Philosophy, A Critical Reconstruction for Modern Times. It is his way of answering to that deep need in China for an adequate ethical basis for political discourse, and it reflects that same combination, as you will see, of appreciation of insights in liberal political thought and a distinctive view that sometimes contrasts with them, sometimes seeks to expose their limitations. Sharing this great project with us, Joseph Chan today will lecture on democracy, human rights, and Confucian values, reconstructing Confucian political thought for China's development.
Thank you, Dick, for such a kind introduction. It's my great delight and honor to be here at Cornell University, and thanks to Professor Dick Miller for inviting me to share my thoughts on Confucian political thought and with Cornell's faculty and students. My thoughts are on a subject on which I've worked for more than a decade. When I first received invitation from Dick to be a speaker at this Rise of China lecture series, I was a bit hesitant because I'm a political theorist, I'm a philosopher, and my work on Confucian political thought has no really direct bearing on the contemporary situation of China in any direct way. And but when I was reading the full title of this lecture series, it's called The Politics and Ethics of the Rise of China. Now, the word ethics, I thought perhaps could give me an excuse to talk about ethical values and ethical foundation from a political thought called Confucianism. And then after hearing or watching the two videos of the last two previous lectures by two distinguished speakers, I also felt able to find some connections between the previous two lectures and mine. The last two lectures talk about the international role of China in Asia and in the rest of the world, as well as Chinese economy. Well, I think both lectures give us a very good introduction to two aspects of China's power, the economic power of China as well as the international political power. So, first of all, is the economic power. According to the series, first of all, is China as an influential, powerful player in the international scene. China being a member of the UN Security Council, have veto power. China being so influential in Asia, and China being armed with nuclear weapons, it really makes China as a powerful player in international politics. But also China is emerging as a powerful economic actor too. And last lecture by Professor Lin talks about China as an economic miracle, China being the second largest economy in the world, etc., etc. Now, China is a big country, and its sheer population, which constitutes 20% of the total population in the world, 20% of humanity, this sheer population can already account for a greater of its influence, positive or negative. And now having been armed with such economic, military, and political power, China's influence can easily reach any part of the world. A big country like China that pursues its interests or agenda through the use of its big stakes could be very threatening to neighboring countries and to other states. So China perhaps needs to think about adopting non-threatening means to influence international politics, to shape behavior of other countries and to perhaps attract voluntary cooperation and compliance. Here we come to the notion of soft power. What is China's soft power in addition to its hard power? Now, this musical instrument is one of the most ancient Chinese instruments. Now, where does China's soft power lie? And what is its foundation and source? Well, political theorists are interested in this concept of soft power because soft power is ultimately linked to values. So soft power seems to give political theorists the pretense of thinking that what we do has practical relevance. It's related to politics in the real world. Now, the United States has a great deal of soft power. Of course, also a lot of hard power. It stands for freedom, equality, human rights, and democracy. There is a large gap between the rhetoric and the reality, of course, but United States does export its political ideals quite effectively at times. And it does so not just by the use of force. So the question is, what does China stand for? Well, to many Westerners and Asians, China stands for these things. Delicious dim sum, I love it. I have it every Saturday or Sunday with my mother and family. Calligraphy, I've learned calligraphy for 2 years and I enjoy this practice. Herbal medicine, I drink large doses of medicine of this kind when I'm ill. Furnitures, fashions. Now these are of course very attractive and interesting to people outside of China. And well, in other parts of the world, China may stand for some other things. In Africa, China stands for, you know, a huge set of programs for training and education, economic aid and diplomatic support. This African Union new building was built by Chinese workers, funded by Chinese money. And this is the very symbol of Chinese presence in Africa and its contribution to African economy. And a lot of self-power going on, you know, as you can see. But soft power comes not just from culture, institution, education, diplomacy, or cuisines, but also, above all, it comes from core values. And according to one commentator, it says, core values form the soul of soft power. If we don't know what China's core values are, the character of Chinese soft power cannot be identified. So what are China's core values? Where is China heading to in terms of its political ideal, its social ideal? Well, here are some usual suspects of China's core values today. High-tech development, high-speed rail, the latest technology in building infrastructure for the whole country. China's core value may also lie in the idea of political stability, political unity within a large country of diverse ethnicities and economic differences. Chinese government also is using the word harmony to describe China's core value, that despite all the differences, Chinese people emphasize harmonious social relationship. But of course, you know, there's a way of the Chinese, local Chinese, responding to the government ideology of harmony. People say that Chinese people are being harmonized by the government rather than really genuinely participating in spontaneous, harmonious relationships. So what are China's core values? It should be things deeper than this, what we have seen in these pictures. I'm suggesting that a search for the core values of country amounts to nothing less than the development of a political thought or political ideology or political philosophy suitable for that country. It is a search for the way, to use the traditional Chinese term, the way, Dao. You know, Confucianism was, of course, the way that has governed China for thousands of years. But in modern China, we have seen huge disruptions, discontinuities, and problems with the Chinese way. First of all, we have seen the emergence or rise of Western liberal thought in late 19th centuries and early 20th centuries, challenging Confucianism, replacing Confucianism. So the May 4th movement was just one very obvious moment in which Chinese culture was really delegated to the dustbin and to be replaced by Western values and institutions. But when China moved into the mid of the 20th century, it adopted another foreign philosophy, Marxism, to replace Western liberalism. And also Confucianism was again heavily destroyed, denounced, and devastated by political forces during the Cultural Revolution time. But towards the 80s in the 20th century and 90s and up to now, we've seen the reemergence of Confucianism again. So you see, Confucianism has got up and down in the political and intellectual history of China. And if you look at the sort of historical influence of Confucianism and how world leaders and philosophers have received Confucianism, you see that there has been a diametrically opposed evaluation of Confucianism. In the 18th century Europe, the most progressive thinkers in Europe regarded Confucianism as perhaps the best ethical and political philosophy in the world. But two centuries later, in the 20th century, the most progressive Chinese thinkers regarded Confucianism as the most wrong-headed, outdated philosophy in the world. Now, what explains such a diametrically opposed attitude? It cannot be explained by reference to the changing nature of Confucianism. Confucianism as a thought, as a political thought, hasn't changed that dramatically to merit or to be able to explain such change. It can only be explained by the changing political, economic, and social circumstances in China and in other parts of the world. Well, however glorious the Confucian tradition has been in China, today Confucianism cannot speak effectively to the new social and political environment in China because traditional Chinese society was disintegrated. The main institutions that build up Confucianism, namely, you know, the peasant economy, the family clan system, imperial bureaucracy and imperial governing system, you know, the educational curriculum, the ritual system, everything have gone in modern China. So the question is, can Confucianism represent itself again as a contemporary political thought that has relevance and that can still provide some hope for and guidance for China's long-term development? Well, this is my own research question, and I've tried my best to find out a way to reconstruct sympathetically Confucian political thought for modern times. Well, let me start with, first of all, the way I approach this huge agenda. And I start with a very gentle, quick notion of what the dual character or function of political philosophy. As I personally see it, this is my own personal view, you don't have to share it. And if you are not a political theorist or philosopher, you shouldn't be too bothered about this technical ways of seeing the function. The first most important function of a political thought or philosophy is to search for an ideal social and political order that expresses the best part of humanity. In Confucianism, you see, does say a lot about what constitutes humanity and what constitutes ideal political and social order. But of course, when we look at the real world, in reality, things always fall short of the ideal. And what should we do in a non-ideal reality situation? Political philosophy should be able to say something that guides us to act politically in non-ideal situation. It should give us principled guidance as to how we should act here and now. So these are the two important functions. And you see that Confucianism has done a lot in the first function. And the problem today for Confucianism is to find out a way to develop certain practical guidance that at once connect, you know, institutions and non-ideal measures to Confucian aspiration and ideal, and at the same time be able to address real-life problems. Now, let me start quickly with a very brief portrait of the Confucian ideal society, as it were. And of course, the most famous passage that people usually cite to articulate this Confucian ideal is a passage from the Confucian classic Li Zi, the book of rites or rituals. this is the idea of datum, you know, the grand union. And according to that famous passage describing this grand union, you know, in this ideal society, datum is a society where the ethic of public spiritedness and mutual care reigns. People conduct affairs in sincerity and faithfulness with the aim of cultivating harmony. And in the political sphere, the virtuous and competent people are chosen to work for the common good. People not only look after their own family members, but also others outside of the family. Different needs are satisfied at different stages of life. The least advantaged, the poorest, receive care and support from society. Adults labor for others as well as for themselves. Goods are not kept merely for personal use, and wastage is frowned upon. Now, in this ideal society, there's no mentioning of the existence of law or rituals. But even if there are laws and rituals, they need not be used because people really are public-spirited and caring and willing to help each other out. Of course, this is very much an ideal. And even in Confucius' time, you know, he realized this is really the golden age myth that is far away from the reality in which he lived. And Confucian thinkers talk about, when they articulate, you know, problems of reality, they articulate a lesser ideal. That is a compromise ideal that Confucians call Xiao Kang. In this less ideal society, certain things emerged, which we could call non-ideal measures. These are like hereditary rule. People built city walls, trenches to protect themselves against invasion. Rules of propriety and righteousness emerged to regulate people's behavior and to regulate and control human conflicts. Now, in this lesser ideal, the use of right is important. It is a concession. It is a concession because rights are backed up with certain sanctions, and rights legitimize certain degree of self-interest. People can talk about their own family more than other people's family. They can talk about their own property rather than other people's property. So Xiao Kang is a concession, but Xiao Kang ideal ultimately still retains certain ethical aspirations in the Grand Union, namely, you know, those virtues such as faithfulness, righteousness, harmony, respect, and those things really are also aspirations you find in Datong. However, even this lesser ideal was regarded as too idealistic in Confucius' time already. So both the Datong and the lesser ideal were bygone ideals. In his time, rituals have disintegrated. Rituals fail to control behaviors of the common people and the elites. And Confucian thought or Confucian thinkers seem to have come to a dead end. They have nothing to recourse on to reconstruct society. They rejected the legalist strategy or solution. Legalism advocates the use of sanctions, the use of punishment and rewards to control behavior, treating humans as animals. And Confucianism cannot accept legalism because legalism gives up hope on the best part of humanity. Confucianism wants to find out practical means to address society needs, but means that can still retain Confucian ideal as an aspiration, if not as an immediate reality that can be reached. Maybe the Confucian ideal is hopeless, but nonetheless, it should still be regarded as an aspiration. People should keep this as, you know, inspiring ideal that would, you know, guide the behavior in reality. So the challenge for Confucianism in the old days and in contemporary situation is the same. That is there any alternative that retains Confucian ideal aspiration and yet effectively tackles problems in a non-ideal world? And I've given myself this challenge. Can we develop a non-ideal solution that retains Confucian aspiration and a solution that is more or less effective? Now, I should explain the nature of my project. I'm not doing intellectual history. I'm not doing history of philosophy. Neither am I doing pure contemporary political philosophy. I'm doing a kind of normative political theory of a special kind. I want to investigate the potential of an ancient tradition and use it to answer or to reflect upon a set of fundamental modern questions like authority, democracy, rights, and liberty. So I have to extrapolate a lot from ancient sources, and I have to draw implication out of it. Historians would not like what I do because they think I would be overgeneralizing, selectively using sources, etc. I can only plead for tolerance because of the purposes I have, you know, because I have normative and practical purposes in mind in approaching Confucian thought. The main line of argument I want to defend is this. I think there's a liberal democratic variant that can be used as a non-ideal means to address situations in contemporary China. And these means can also somehow be shown to be connected to Confucian aspirations. Now, this is not a one-way project. I'm not just assuming liberal democracy as a fixed point of reference and then show how it can help Confucianism to solve problems. It is a two-way street. In doing this, I'm also re-articulating the functions and the justification of liberal democratic institutions. And I want to really mix liberal democratic institutions with Confucian values in a way that makes both set of things stronger rather than weaker. So I hope my project can also be a contribution to the strengthening of liberal democratic institutions and not just strengthening Confucian political thought. Well, but because this is a huge project and I can only focus on one topic, which is democracy. I don't have time to go into, I'm afraid, human rights. Tomorrow in a workshop with faculty and graduate students, I will focus primarily on the issue of human rights and civil liberties. So today I've just used democracy and Confucianism as an example to show how this approach works. Well, for many people, democracy and Confucianism are diametrically opposed things. Confucianism talks about hierarchy, authority, and virtues, and democracy talks about equality, rights, citizens' participation, and they seem very different things. But my strategy is to, first of all, disconnect liberal institutions democratic institutions from democratic ideologies or values. So the first step of my strategy is to disconnect institutions from its justification. And I would connect the two in two ways. I would try to develop, you know, an expressive relationship between democracy and Confucianism, as well as an instrumental relationship. By expressive relationship, I mean the claim or the view that democracy expresses certain normative ideals or values that Confucianism endorses. Now, this is a very counterintuitive claim. How can democracy as an institution express Confucian value? I'm going to show why this could be plausible. And then instrumentally, I'm going to argue that democracy can bring about certain effects which are desirable in the view of Confucian thought. And of course, towards the later part of my lecture, I will talk about how Confucian values in turn can enrich and further promote democratic politics or the health of democratic institutions. Now, let us talk about expressive relationship first. As I said, I need to disconnect democracy from certain values and principles. For example, the value or the principle of popular sovereignty or political equality. Democracy as an institution is often justified by these sort of principles. Democracy embodies popular sovereignty. It embodies political equality as a moral principle. Confucianism, however, does not accept the idea of popular sovereignty or political equality as a moral ideal. In terms of political authority, Confucianism has a very interesting and I think a pretty distinctive and unique view of political authority. One important element of the Confucian conception of political authority is what I've called service conception, to borrow a term used by Joseph Ress. Of course, he doesn't use it in the way I use it. For Confucian thinkers, at least for early Confucian thinkers, political authority must be justified by its service to the well-being of the people. A ruler is legitimate. He has legitimate authority only if the ruler is able to work for the well-being of the people. So there is a strong consequentialist, so to speak, justification of authority there. And there is no natural or fundamental moral right to power. There's no natural rulership or prince or king in Confucianism. The ruler has to justify his power, has to justify his blessing from heavens, has to justify his heaven's mandate by being virtuous, being committed to care for the well-being of people. Now, if that is the case, then it also implies that there is no natural power or authority for the people as well. Political authority, whether it is in the hands of the few or the one or the many, has to be justified instrumentally, in part, by the service to the people. It means that people cannot naturally claim that they are political rulers themselves. Now, the fact that democracy gives political power to every citizen, distributes power equally, is interesting. And Confucianism may accept this, but not on the ground that people are born with natural political power, like what John Locke has argued. John Locke really is saying that in a state of nature, we are our own political master. Well, this creates a lot of controversies. I'm here. I don't have time to defend this service conception view, and we could discuss it in a discussion. But let us assume we can disconnect democratic institutions from democratic principles. And then how can we reconnect democracy and institution with Confucian values? Well, first of all, we should look at how Confucian thinkers understand political relationship, an ideal political relationship. Well, for Confucians, politics not only concerns power and the use of authority, politics is above all a kind of relationship between the ruled and the ruler. Political relationship is authoritative, yes. It's hierarchical, yes. But it is not top-down, and it is not one-sided, according to Confucianism. It is mutual, it is trustful. Political authority has to be won, and people are expected to freely submit to political authority. Well, look at this several passages I got from the Analects. I'll just read them quickly. Without the trust of the people, no government can stand. Good faith inspires the trust of the people. Confucius says, ensures that those who are near are pleased and those who are far away are attracted. When he was asked about the way of governance, he said, well, don't use force. Don't use coercion, but attract them to come. And if they have come, make sure that they are pleased. And Confucius also says, when people submit to the, this is Mencius. Mencius says, when people submit to the transforming influence of virtue, they do so sincerely, with admiration in their hearts. 心悦诚服. An example of this is the submission of the 70 disciples to Confucius. Mencius is using Confucius as an example, role model for rulers. Mencius is telling the rulers, saying, be virtuous and be a role model so that your people sincerely submit to you with admiration of you. So according to this Confucian ideal relationship, there is this mutual commitment. The rulers are committed to care for the well-being of the people, and they are trustworthy. The rule, in turn, express their willing submission and endorsement and support for the ruler. But notice this is different from Lockean understanding. Confucians are not saying that, well, people are born with natural political rights, so rulers must obtain consent and support from the ruler, from the ruled, in order to have legitimacy. It's not Lockean. The argument here is based on a certain perfectionist understanding of relationship. It's emotional, it's about virtue, it's about the desirable characteristics of political relationship. Now, how is this conception of political relationship connected to democratic institutions? I'm suggesting that the point of democratic election is precisely, or could be understood as, to select those who are public-spirited, trustworthy, and caring, and also to make explicit the public's endorsement and support of those who are elected. Well, look at the inauguration ceremony of the U.S. president, for example. When a president is elected, and the president has to swear in, has to pledge, give an oath, and pledge himself or herself to the people, saying, I will work for the national interest, the common good of the people, and not for any sectorial interest. I will do my best to be faithful and to abide by the constitution. It's not just U.S. If you look at the presidential oath in Japan, in India, and other democratic countries, it's all written like this. And then the voters, the citizens, will gather together and cheers and show their support for the elected leaders. Now, is this just a Western democratic ideal? No. Confucianism, 2,500 years ago, has portrayed this sort of relationship, and of course, in its own language and terms. Now, I'm not saying that democracy is the only possible way to express this very not intimate, but desirable, close, mutual commitment relationship. In principle, a monarch could be also well be supported, could be shown as trustworthy and caring. So in a monarchical system, it could also win support. But I think that democratic institutions give the most direct institutional expression of this relationship. So the elections in particular are both a means of selecting good rulers and a way of expressing the mutual commitments of the ruler and the people. It's not the only means, but it's the most effective means of expressing this. Well, this is not only my view. In the 19th century, when Chinese Confucian thinkers have traveled abroad to observe democratic politics in England, for example, they were very impressed. Wang Tao helped Zhen Select to translate the five classics. And he himself was an educated Confucian scholar and very influential in politics too. Wang Tao traveled to England and was very impressed and has written this observation, no doubt very idealistic to you. Maybe he was not giving the full, most accurate view. This is not my point. I'm not saying he gives the accurate historical picture of England, but this is how he saw the connection between democratic life and the so-called golden age of Confucianism. He says the real strength of England, however, lies in the fact that there is a sympathetic understanding between the governing and governed, a close relationship between the ruler and the people. My observation is that the daily domestic political life of England actually embodies the traditional ideals of our ancient golden age, Da Tong, he was referring to, the one that I've just described. And he goes on, in official appointments, the method of recommendation and election is practiced, but the candidates must be well-known, of good character and achievements before they can be promoted to a position over the people. And moreover, the principle of majority rule is adhered to in order to show impartiality. This is the word, this is, you know, public spiritedness in the Da Tong ideal. The English people are likewise public spirited and law abiding. The laws and regulations are hung up high for everyone to see, and no one dares violate them. So this is the way Wang Tao, you know, saw the connection between Confucian ideal and democracy. So far, so good. Well, let's assume I've shown the possibility of connecting things. But of course, this is a very ideal scenario. You know, we are assuming that politicians are virtuous, caring, and they are elected by the people, and people also care about virtues of the elected officials too. In non-ideal situation, however, not every politician and voters possess the virtue and ability necessary for achieving the ideal relationship. Often, politicians have mixed motives. They have public spirits, or they have public-spirited attitudes, but they also have self-interested attitudes or interest in power and vanity. Now, how does democratic election fare in non-ideal situation? Well, elections can still be effective in situations like what I've just described, because elections can serve two functions. The selection function, selecting the virtuous and the able, and also the sanction functions, because elections can sanction politicians who are not so good. So, for example, elections can compel the not so virtuous and not so public-spirited politicians to work for the people. And if they mess up, people can rise up and throw them out of office in the next election. So elections do seem to be a pretty effective means to protect people's self-interest, legitimate self-interest, I mean. In that way, elections can at once address practical problems and make some connections through this selection function to Confucian ideals or the ideal political relationships. This is, however, not to say that there's no tension between democracy as a political system and Confucianism. And now I'm moving into the second part of my lecture. Well, first of all, elections are necessarily competitive, and they necessarily produce winners and losers. In non-ideal situations, elections may induce highly antagonistic rivalry among candidates. We all know this, you know, when we watch elections in presidential elections or legislative elections. Now, of course, politicians also try to win votes by offering policies that are only good to the short-term interests and detrimental to the long-term interests of society. I don't need time to really go over all these problems. You're all familiar with the problems of elections. And I just want to cite a few prominent American liberal democratic philosophers. They themselves are very unhappy with the situation of democratic politics. Amy Gutman and Dennis Thompson said, you know, in the practice of our democratic politics, they're referring to America, communicating by sound bites competing by character assassination and resolving political conflicts through self-seeking bargaining too often substitute for deliberation on the merits of controversial issues. Ronald Dworkin, another prominent legal and political philosopher, says this: American politics are in an appalling state. We disagree fiercely about almost everything. We disagree about terror and security, social justice, religion and politics, who is fit to be a judge, and what democracy is. These are not civil disagreements. Each side has no respect for the other. We are no longer partners in self-government. Our politics are rather a form of war. Now, these words come from, you know, American thinkers, not from Singaporean politicians or Malaysian politicians or Chinese politicians. Well, I think we can understand why Judge Louis Brandeis says the following. I think it is a very wise view. He said, in a democracy, the most important office is the office of citizen. Why? Because the quality of democratic politics and governance ultimately depends on the virtue and intelligence of the people. If you got bad rulers, you can get rid of them through elections. But if the people themselves are bad, elections have nothing to help. Elections can actually feed all this badness into the very process. That's why Madison says something like this. He said, well, democracy works only if the people have virtue and intelligence to select men of virtue and wisdom. Is there no virtue among us? If there be not, we are in a wretched situation. No theoretical checks, no form of government can render us secure. To suppose that any form of government will secure liberty or happiness without any virtue in the people is a chimerical idea. I think this is a profound truth should be shared by anyone who understands a little bit about democratic politics. Now, what should be done? Well, Confucians are very concerned about this problem, because if democratic politics in the non-ideal real world produces antagonism, conflicts, short-term interests, injustice, disharmony, etc., then this really goes deeply against the Confucian ideal or aspiration. What needs to be done, I think, is for democracy to be supplemented with a strong ethical foundation and alternative institutions. And I think we can draw on Confucian resources to do that. And this is how I think Confucianism can provide some positive inputs to the health of democratic politics. Let's start with civility when we talk about ethical foundation. Of course, Western thinkers have known the importance of civility for a long time. This is nothing, you know, Western or East Asian. Now, civility is important for people in politics, and especially for strangers, for people who are not intimates. We need civility to deal with our interaction and disagreement. Now, people say that civility is a virtue that disposes people to be polite, respectful, tolerant, and decent to one another. Some others say that civility is behavior in public which demonstrates respect for others and which entails curtailing one's own immediate self-interest when appropriate. And still some others say that civility is a civic orientation that does not duck conflict altogether, but that simultaneously embraces the importance of maintaining harmonious social relationship. So how can we maintain civility in the context of disagreement and potential conflict? Well, you might think, well, this is, of course, very important, but how can we get anything like civility from Confucian ethics? Isn't Confucian ethics about family, clan ethics, filial piety? Isn't Confucianism about, you know, intimate relationship? Can Confucian ethics teach anything about civility? Well, I think so. And there are profound teachings about civility in Confucian texts. Well, just take a look at these several passages. From the Analects, the master Confucius said, "The gentleman seeks harmony, not sameness. The petty person seeks sameness, not harmony. The gentleman will not seek..." this is a very condensed statement. It means something like the following, I think. It requires interpretation. It means that the gentleman will not seek sameness or conformity without principle. And it will not just be seeking self-interest. On the other hand, being a principled person, the gentleman is not imposing or is not being too competitive, but maintains harmony with others. I think there are two qualities behind, you know, a gentleman who is civil. The first is non-partisanship. Well, unlike the petty person, the gentleman doesn't form cliques, doesn't form parties that pursue self-interest or narrow group interest. Implicit in this attitude is a concern for the common good, for righteousness. And for example, you know, here you got some passages. The gentleman is associated openly with others, is not partisan. Well, these are other passages. You know, gentleman is self-esteeming but not contentious, gregarious but not factious. There's another quality. Being a principled person, the gentleman remains true to his principle, but yet is able to maintain harmonious relationship. Now, how is it possible? Well, Confucius doesn't say too much. He gives us an interesting example, the archery competition. He said, gentlemen are not competitive, except when they have to be in an archery ceremony. Greeting, like bowing with hands folded in front of the chest, you know, greeting to each other first before you rise to the platform and do the archery, and then making way for each other round. The archers ascend the hall, returning, they drink a salute. After they are done, they drink and together, you know, and celebrate the gentleman competition. Well, for Confucius, competition can be gentlemanly if it is embedded in rituals that express a spirit of respect and civility. The notion, the Chinese word "rang," to give way, is very rich in meaning. It's not just being respectful. It's not just being civil, but it really means some giving way to people, giving way to the weak, yielding, compromising, deferring for the sake of maintaining a good relationship with others. He says, well, the rulers are able to effect order in the state through the combination of observing ritual propriety and deferring to others what more is needed. But if they are not able to accomplish this, what have they to do with observing ritual and ritual propriety? To observe ritual, you have to have this spirit of deferring, rang. You know, to give way, to make compromise. And there are other passages which you don't have time. In politics, rang, the spirit of give way, is expressed through this very fundamental principle, is to select the virtuous and give it to the able. That is, if you find somebody who is more virtuous and more competent than you, then you give way. Let that person take up office, take up responsibility, recommend the virtuous and yield to the able. But however, when you think that actually you are better than others, you are more benevolent, you are more able than others, then you do not give way, you just recommend yourself, you will seek opportunity to make use of your own virtue and talent and to contribute to the public. So, well, there we could summarize a few principles of civility from the sources of Confucianism. Priority of the common good, yielding to people, but when you think you can contribute to the common good better than others, then you have the duty to participate in politics to promote the good. But in competing and offering yourself, you do so with respect and in civility, with civility. Now, you think these are very idealistic precepts, but to the extent that a society view this as too idealistic, it really shows that society is in a terrible situation, is in a sorry state. You know, in an ideal situation, in a healthy society, these precepts are just everyday norms that people follow. If in reality very few people follow these norms, it really means that the society is not that healthy. Now, how can we instill civility and related virtues in people? How can we help people practice these precepts? For Confucians, they can be done through moral education. Confucians have invested a great deal of thinking, reflection, and resources into programs of moral education, educational curriculum. This is a rather substantive kind of moral education, which is quite foreign or not amenable or not attractive to mainstream liberal thinking. Well, liberals want to, you know, dissociate themselves from a whole set of moral ideals which are controversial and may be disagreed upon by others. Now, what is the mainstream liberal thinking about civility, the education of civility, and whether this thinking is sufficient, is good enough? And I'm arguing that it's not good enough, and it's limited. Traditionally, democratic theorists do not talk about moral education or even civic education. They rather want to think that if you let citizens to participate, you know, if you follow Tocqueville's line of argument, let them participate in civic association, town hall meetings, political campaigns, they will sooner or later acquire virtues and civility. But this is, in reality, I think, too idealistic. Because a lot of political scientists have done a lot of research to show that participation can lead to serious conflicts if participants are not civil themselves. Political discussions among people of different views can lead to polarization of position, animosity, and resentment if they are not conducted in the spirit of civility. So actually, you need civility to make sure participation can bring about, you know, healthy or more virtues in civility. And even when liberals talk about the necessity of education, they prefer the term civic education to moral education. And they think of civic education in narrow terms, like, you know, education of people's critical thinking, acquisition of knowledge of public affairs. For example, Benjamin Barber, a very well-known democratic theorist, he says civic education primarily means equal access to civic information and the holding of local and national discussions. For Ronald Dworkin, civic education means the introduction, I'm quoting him, a contemporary politics course to every high school curriculum, so as to instill some sense of complexity of the political controversies of the day, some understanding of positions different from those the students are likely to find at home or among friends, and some idea of what a conscientious and respectful argument over the uses might look like. You think, well, is critical thinking enough? No. Is knowledge enough? No. These are just cognitive abilities. They are not yet virtues or ethical dispositions. If you want to help people develop civic virtues, you really need some kind of other means. And liberals said, okay, we need to talk about civic virtues and civic education directly and not through indirectly other means. But even when they talk about civic virtues, they talk about these virtues as instrument to well-functioning deliberative processes and not as human virtues. And Confucianism talks about civility as human qualities, as human virtues, and not civic virtues. And for example, Confucius says, you know, conduct yourself with respect, perform your duties with reverence, treat others with wholehearted sincerity, even if you should journey to Yi and Di, really foreign countries, barbaric areas, then you cannot abandon this. Now, these are the very human virtues that you need to cultivate, and you need to practice them in whatever situation you find yourself in. And there are other passages saying, well, we should cultivate five things that constitute humanity: respectfulness, lenience, truthfulness, industry, and beneficence. Well, why do I think that moral education is more important or necessary than civic education? I can think of three reasons. First of all, moral education is about educating a good person. Civic education is about educating a good citizen. Well, if you do not care too much about politics or being a citizen, if you are primarily concerned about your family, work, you know, friends, then you don't feel the incentive, the will to cultivate citizens' virtues, because citizens' life doesn't appeal to you. But if you think that these civic virtues are actually human virtues, then I'm sure that for a normal person, there's a stronger desire to be a good person, or at least to appear to others to be a good person, rather than to be a good citizen. We want to be a good citizen, but we want more to be a good person. So there's, I think, a stronger incentive to practice and cultivate civic virtues when they are regarded as marks of a good person. And secondly, moral education provides a lot of opportunities and expectation. You're expected to practice these virtues in different places, not just in citizens' forum, in political spheres. And there is always an assurance problem when we come to civic virtues. If other citizens do not behave civilly, justly, why should I behave? You know, my civic virtue is conditional upon other people's willing compliance. But if you treat yourself, these virtues as good citizens, as a good people's virtues, then even people are bad towards you. You do not easily just brush aside your virtues, because in doing so, you're changing yourself as a person. Now, so much about, you know, a case for Confucian virtues and moral education, which is, I think, important to democratic politics. But how about institutions? Can we think of institutions or ways to improve and strengthen democratic institutions? Well, a lot of political scientists and philosophers are quite pessimistic about our ability to reform, refashion democratic institutions, legislature, party politics, political parties. We have known all the problems, and we have not yet found ways to really improve these institutions. So instead, theorists have turned to, again, democratic participation, citizens' participation, deliberative politics at the grassroots level. But what about institutions at the top level, elite level? What about helping political elites to improve themselves in terms of behavior and in terms of institutional development? Well, I'm suggesting perhaps that we could consider something which is quite foreign in the Western political culture, which is the adoption of a non-democratically elected second chamber to balance, you know, a democratically elected first chamber. This is not just an ancient idea. It was thought about by John Stuart Mill. Even Hayek himself said something like that. First of all, what is the value of a second chamber? Well, it contributes to governance. If you can select really virtuous and competent people, let's assume this for the sake of argument at this moment, if you can find these people and place them in the second chamber, they contribute to democratic deliberation. They contribute to lawmaking. and to the monitoring of government. But above all, this serves as a model. It serves educational purposes. These second chamber members may serve as a role model for other politicians and other citizens. The way they deliberate, the manner they speak, the way they treat their opponents in deliberation, you know, should be educative. Well, there are three common issues surrounding this sort of second chamber institution. The first, of course, is legitimacy. It's not democratically elected. Confucians are not too worried about. If you buy Confucians' conception, surface conception of authority, an institution, a particular way of distributing power, is to be assessed by, first of all, its contribution to the well-being of people, and second, assessed by whether or not it captures the ideal political relationship. Well, but the most common criticism of this second chamber is this, that there's no reliable way of identifying virtuous and competent rulers. Well, this can take two forms, this criticism. First is there's simply no objective basis for differentiating people according to their virtue and competence. I think this is wrong. I don't have time to go into it, but just think of these ordinary virtues we expect of people and leaders: trustworthiness, integrity, fairness, open-mindedness, being responsible, being competent. Now, we make evaluative judgments of people according to these standards all the time in our daily lives. When we recruit colleagues, when we promote people to the chair of a department, dean, you know, we evaluate candidates according to this understanding of their ability and virtues. But even if conceptually we know what is expected of these people in terms of virtue, even if we have experience of differentiating the virtuous from the not so virtuous, but there seems no reliable institutional mechanism to select them. And this is a more difficult challenge to meet. Well, some people, some Confucian scholars like Daniel A. Bell have proposed competitive examination to select them. And he called the house of virtue and talent. So people have to sit for examination to test for economic and political knowledge of contemporary world, knowledge of philosophy and literature. In the case of China, you know, the Chinese classics and Chinese history. Also, examination should consist of essay questions on ethics to help filter our political demagogues and brilliant but morally insensitive technocrats. But there are clear limitations to this method. Examination can only test ethical knowledge at the most, not ethical dispositions. Knowledge is one thing, the disposition to act is another. So I'm suggesting perhaps we should consider another institution. I don't have time to go through this. This is an idea that I draw from a Tang Dynasty intellectual. The idea is that it is very hard to get to know people. The only way to select the virtuous and the competent is to observe these people over an extended period of time so that you have sure knowledge of their virtues and abilities. And Lu Zi, he recommended, you know, the principle of recommendation by local prestigious elderly and officials, because these people in local districts, they mingle with other people, they get to know a lot of people, so they know who are good and know who are not good, and they recommend. A contemporary variant I'm proposing is selection by colleagues, and I'm running my lecture very soon. Well, how am I going to select virtuous people? Well, first of all, we should target not beginners, but experienced public civil servants, public servants, like seniors, like retired legislators, judges, chairmen of statutory bodies, diplomats, etc., etc. Not all of them are competent or virtuous, but if they can really climb up the rank and have been observed by people, then this gives us a pool. And now, who are the ones to select them? Well, I say these three sort of people, at least. Well, this public servant, senior public servants themselves, because they know each other, at least in certain committees and organizations, and senior secretariat staff who have worked with them for a long period of time, and also experienced journalists who have been following these people's reports and news. You know, they are the ones who have observed these people and know about their character and ability. Now, what are the roles and powers of this second chamber? Well, it depends on the development of politics and culture in the society. It could be a strong role, a guardian vetoing this first chamber. It could be an equal role, like a partner. It could be a weak role, like simply an advisor, like the current House of Lords in England. And in terms of, you know, the terms of the membership, there need not be any fixed terms of seats. Members could serve a maximum of 2 terms, let's say, and the standard corruption prevention measures applied to the second chamber as well as to the first chamber. So this is one way I think we could develop a non-democratic institution to balance, you know, the democratic first chamber and contribute to democratic deliberation. Well, just to conclude, I'm running out of time. I think Confucianism and democracy can be linked expressively and instrumentally in both directions. And a well-functioning democracy needs a virtuous citizenry to prevent it from degenerating into an antagonistic political competition based solely on narrow interest. And Confucian ethical insight and reflection can make democracy ethically more attractive and practically more feasible. Thank you so much for your attention. Yes, I don't think Confucianism is a necessary, indispensable moral resource for thinking about improving democracy. Christianity, you know, I don't know much about Buddhism, but Christianity does talk about moral education, and it has its own tension with democracy in ways which are different from the Confucian problem with democracy. But yes, I'm not claiming that you must learn from Confucianism. I'm just offering Confucianism as a source for Westerners. But my primary interest is not telling what Western democracy should do. My interest is actually developing a view for China, how Chinese people can make use of their own cultural resources and ethical resources to not only to make use of democracy, but improve democracy in their own way.
not very relevant, but refers to the values that the democracy you just mentioned. I think many people regard China, nowadays China, as a country where her people have a lack of beliefs. And however they trust that beliefs can bring people not only aspiration, but also fears, so that they can behave So I just want to know what you think of the lack of belief.
Yes, obviously I agree with you that there is a moral vacuum, so to speak, in China. There's a lack of a set of moral and political ideals or beliefs that command respect and adherence of a majority of the Chinese population. And the reason for this moral vacuum has much to do with the way Chinese Confucian culture was disintegrated and not yet replaced by another powerful ideological beliefs. Liberalism has yet to grow, and Marxism is still the official ideology, but people are just paying lip service to it. And also, another reason for this lack of moral virtue is the corruption of the institutions in China. So when people observe, find out the officials are corrupted and they are not really following the law, and they gain a great deal of benefits from bribery and whatnot, then why should I, you know, be complying, be a law-abiding citizen, you know, when other people are not complying with law? Why should I? So these various reasons have contributed to a great deal of problem of moral decay in Chinese society today. And the solution is very complex, in that there's no easy solution. You have to build institutions that are fair, that are not corrupted, and you also have to start moral education from scratch. You know, you have to redesign school curriculum, et cetera, et cetera. I mean the moral decay, moral vacuum.
Everything you said.
Right.
Joseph, can I ask you about something that seems to be left out? I think there's a lot of people who call themselves broadly liberal would say that one very important function of political justice is to respect people in a morally informed interest in self-rule, in being authors of their own lives, and that has great inherent importance, even though it's not all important. And I think that's one reason why many of us would say that depriving an adult of suffrage, of a vote, is, among other things, an insult. I guess it's also a reason of why we'd say that it's important for there to be a Bill of Rights protecting people in the fundamental aspects of their self-rule, their autonomy, setting limits to democracy. It wasn't clear to me what the standing of that fundamental interest was in your account. You talk about people yielding to one another. Now, someone like me would say, well, yeah, yielding's important, but that's important because one is acknowledging people's interest in self-rule. But would you put it that way? It doesn't seem to fit.
That's a very good question and a difficult one. First of all, we have an interest in personal autonomy. This notion of personal autonomy is entirely foreign to Confucian ethics. And I think a contemporary version of Confucian ethics has to absorb or appeal to some mild notion of personal autonomy, like being able to choose a path of life, you know, a career plan, religious beliefs, et cetera, et cetera. But personal autonomy is one thing. Self-rule, in the political sense, is, I think, another. Personal autonomy doesn't imply that you must have a political right to make collectively binding decisions with others. A lot of libertarians think, actually, that, you know, the best ideal political form or form of political government is a libertarian one. Just leave me aside And that is the best guarantee for personal autonomy. Whether the government is elected or not, it's an empirical question, but it's not the most fundamental one. The most fundamental thing is to have a limited government, very, very limited, so that we have a big sphere in which we can decide upon on our own lives. Now, you also mentioned, an insult to people's dignity or self-respect. I can concede this could be a valid argument, but this is a cultural argument, I think. That is to say that within certain culture in which people tie their dignity with a vote, with the ability to participate in democratic election, yes, for this culture, democracy is intrinsically desirable and intrinsically necessary. It's not just instrumentally useful, because it really is the necessary embodiment of our dignity, et cetera, et cetera. But I can readily see there are cultures and societies in which people do not tightly connect dignity or self-respect with electoral votes. That's my view. I may be wrong. Right. Yeah, that's a good question. Now, I'm an academic. When I talk about second chamber, it's really pie in the sky, you know. It doesn't mean things will come out that way. When we really have to be very serious about institutional design, then we have to look at the context and conditions. You know, a lot of institutions' development are just path dependent. You know, the notion that you are not at liberty to freely redesign a set of institutions as if, you know, let's start from square one and redesign them. It's not like this. You have to build upon existing practices, modify them, change them. Now, is there any current institutions in China that can be slightly modified so as to go along this way of second chamber? I think so. It's the National Consultative Committee, you know, the Zhengxie. You know, this is a consultative, it doesn't really have the legislative power, unlike the People's Congress. But these people taking part in this consultative institution, intellectuals, some well-established businessmen, and respected people in society, they are recommended to sit on them and to give advice on policies and law. Now, we could revise this thing and in light of this second model, empowering them a little bit and also be more careful in the way selecting them, et cetera, et cetera. So there is, I think, some empirical path that we could develop a second chamber, not from a completely new way, but using a current institution as a basis. Can you speak louder? I can't hear you. Well, thank you. I don't think Confucian thinkers would have any problem accepting certain institutional devices such as separation of powers. I should really qualify it. In one of my chapters of the book that I've just completed, I spent a whole chapter saying Confucian conception of authority as being a monist supreme conception is wrong, and I have to reject it to allow the notion of separation of power to come in. But I don't think Confucian thinkers would object to the institution or to the notion of a Bill of Rights that is used to protect legitimate fundamental interests of humans or citizens. I don't see any conflict between Confucian ideas and the idea of judicial review and a Bill of Rights to protect a minority. I did see a conflict, as I said, between separation of power and the early Confucian conception of authority being supreme and monist, one single. But my recommendation is to reject the Confucian belief for the idea of separation of power. So I'm not accepting the whole of Confucian political thought, as you can see.
Something that heretofore is peripheral to the other kind of justificational sources found in Confucianism. That's what I was thinking. But my question is, what would be the foundational justification for bringing in this sphere of personal autonomy? There's a kind of liberal notion, which is besides the kind of Rawlsian notions, right, or the kinds of justifications that Dick was hinting at, there's also the instrumental justification, that's a million justification, and that seems like that would be amenable to Confucianism, but it also seemed like there's an additional source, which I hadn't thought of before, and that is coming from this idea of yielding, that is, there's a foundation for them, or a justification for bringing in the sphere of personal autonomy, which may come from the vice of coercion and not yielding to other people, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering what you saw the justification for this additional.
Yes, that's a good question. There's a notion of moral autonomy in Confucian ethics, but it's different from personal autonomy. Moral autonomy meaning that a person engages in moral life has to be reflective and has to reflectively endorse the demands of morality. So a person is not leading a moral life if it is just coerced into it. But that's the moral autonomy notion doesn't bring you very far. It doesn't tell you that you can freely choose about your marriage partner, your career, your work, you know. In traditional Confucian Chinese society, it is the parents who really dictate the children in terms of marriage partner, work, career. And I can see why, you know, in an agricultural peasant economy, the family is not just a family, it's an economic unit. You need a head, you know, to devise the labor, divide the labor, et cetera, et cetera. You need continuity of labor and whatnot. And Confucianism in the past also talks a lot about obedience and filial piety, which do not fit comfortably with the idea of personal autonomy. But again, the importance of obedience and filial piety has to be understood against this peasant economy background. In the old days, there weren't many career choices for people. You know, either you continue to plow your land or you go to the city. You know, but now today, in a pluralistic modern society, there are so many careers, so many occupations, so many ways of life. Even if you are being a caring parent, you want your child to live the best life, you wouldn't want to dictate him, to tell him what to do, because you have to let him try and make you know, develop their own rational capacity to have the capacity to make choices so as to flourish. And in a fast-changing society, you know, what you have learned as a parent when you were young are no longer relevant to the young people. is easily outdated, you know, your experience and things. So I can see there is a strong sociological argument for making room for personal autonomy. Personal autonomy actually is important only against certain fundamental facts about modern society. It's pluralism, it's fast-changing nature, et cetera, et cetera.